gold finished the best two-week run of the year, while the precious metals equities sector continued to rebound from oversold conditions. Welcome, everybody. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with you for another big show this weekend. In this encore episode, the featured guest list includes Rich Dad Robert Kiyosaki, Steve Forbes, and Jay Taylor, plus a new editorial from Robert Ian. The regular show returns next week with all new interviews, so we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek.com Radio.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for the excellent radio show. I got a quick question about the deal between Iran and China. And specifically, everything I've heard you say on the radio is that once gold goes into China, it's illegal for it to come out. Is that illegal for citizens? Because if there's a deal where China is buying Iran's oil for gold, then is it that the only gold coming out of China is through the government to make big purchases? Or why aren't they using their reserves of dollars and selling it that way? So thanks for clearing up that. Hope you have a great one. Please keep on doing a great show. Have a great one. Bye.
And the first caller would like to know why China is importing so much gold, and if it's circumventing the dollar payment blockade with Iran by using gold as a substitute currency. Well, caller, what a fantastic point you've made here. You're way ahead of most of the analysts that I read. In 2011, President Obama imposed trade sanctions on Iran to halt their nuclear enrichment program. Now, these sanctions punish any foreign financial institution which conducts transactions with Iran for its crude oil, cutting off Iran from the U.S. financial system. Now, China is Iran's largest trading partner, but the nation is also heavily dependent, of course, on trade with the U.S. So officials in Tehran agreed to accept gold as payment for oil. So there you have it, a likely component in the recent gold sell-off. However, I would note that this really only postpones the reckoning day. Eventually, I expect the gold paid to Iran to find its way back to China and India, who will promptly use the dollars to make gold purchases, thus reversing the lopsided process and eventually leading to runaway global inflation and very high precious metals prices.
Hi, my name is Moses, and I'm calling about what to do if I have 20 or 30K that I want to invest, take it out of sitting in my bank doing nothing. But I'll need it for in about 4 to 6 months. I need to withdraw it. And should I be buying gold stocks or some of your stock picks? I have some longer-term metals that I'm holding on to for 4 years now. But I wanted to do something to take advantage of this dip in the market.
All right, next up, Moses says he has around $30,000, if I understood his statement there correctly, in his savings account. He'll need to use the funds in about 4 to 6 months, and he has a long-term position in the precious metals. He'd like to know if I recommend any gold stock picks or any of my Alpha Stocks newsletter picks. First off, congratulations on accumulating a solid core portfolio. You are way ahead of most Americans, most of whom do not have even $1,000 in savings. Now, it sounds like you could use some diversification and higher yield growth exposure. A savings account will not provide either of these important components. Since you have a solid precious metals portfolio already, I would suggest diversifying into high-yielding bonds and high-yielding dividend-paying stocks. Then, depending on your risk tolerances and stage in life, you might direct 5 or 10% of your funds into a risky stock with explosive potential. For instance, each week I provide a moonshot stock candidate. These are stocks with very low float, usually undervalued by at least 95 to 99% or more, given the current discounted cash flow method, and with technical conditions that suggest a 1 to even 100-fold increase. Now, by limiting your exposure to such risky plays, you minimize risk while maximizing the potential return. If a stock climbs, let's say, 500% and you've only used about 10% or so of your funds, your portfolio increases by over 50%. But if the stock tumbles, you can never lose more than 10% of your portfolio. This 1 to 5 or so, 1 to 3, 1 to 5 risk to reward ratio is ideal. Plus, I include 5 mega dividend stocks each week with a typical dividend yield of 10 to 12% with at least 100% growth potential. However, I cannot recommend my service to you at this time, unfortunately, because these stock candidates are long-term oriented. Your 4 to 6 month time horizon will not meet that requirement. But if you decide to become a longer-term investor with your equities and bonds, I suggest, you know, by all means, sign up for the newsletter.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing? This is Marcus from Brooklyn. I had a quick question here about gold lease rates. I was looking at the chart, and it appears that the 30-day gold lease rate, as well as the 60-day and the 6-month lease rate, appeared to have gone negative on April around the 18th or the 19th. And essentially, it appears that for a brief period of a couple days, the percentage was actually negative, which would, I suppose, mean that someone was paying people to hold gold. I'm not quite sure. But any insight on that would be interesting. Hope you're well. Thanks so much for everything you do. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Marcus from Brooklyn asks about the negative gold lease rate. And this is simply the rate that you would receive if you were to lease your gold. Usually it's institutions and governments that are leasing their gold. So you wouldn't expect the rate to be zero unless there was a surplus of gold in circulation. However, I note that, you know, the 1 to 3 month lease rates are well above the troughs that were carved out in 2011 and 2012 and do not seem to be a particular concern here. You might want to view the amazing lease rate spike during the credit crisis. It's really quite a sight to behold. All right, that quickly powers through all the questions and comments, closing down the phone line. And remember, folks, we'd like to field your questions and comments. I couldn't get to the email. No time for email. The calls take priority. You can call in anytime you like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's toll-free within the United States and probably parts of Canada as well. The number, 1-800-507-6531. 800-507-6531. If you'd like, you can jot it down on a post-it pad and keep that close to your phone. Or you might just plug 800-507-6531 right into your cell phone or home phone for quick and easy access. And once again, you can reach us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can cancel at any time you like. You don't have to speak to anyone. You can delete and start over again as many times as you like. Well, my featured guest today has over 30 years of experience in the precious metals field. Mr. Jay Taylor, editor of Jay Taylor's Gold Energy Tech Stocks newsletter, host of the web-based radio show Turning Hard Times into Good Times. Welcome back, Mr. Taylor.
Good to be with you.
You know, I understand that you are interested in a couple of stocks that are also favorites of GoldSeek.com analysts, including Golden Arrow Resources and Timmins Gold. So I thought we might begin today with Golden Arrow. That's ticker GRG.TO at StockCharts.com. Golden Arrow Resources is a Vancouver-based exploration company. They focus primarily on Argentina, and I understand the flagship property is the Chinchillas property, located in the prolific Bolivian silver-zinc-tin belt. I understand that some interesting results they've had there recently, and I thought you might tell us more about the Chinchillas silver property.
Yeah, it really looks to me like they're onto something potentially very large there, and they've had some really good numbers, some really impressive intersections of silver with some base metals as well, some lead and some zinc. You know, like, for example, they recently, with 108 meters of 125 grams per ton silver, 1.2% lead, 20 meters of 379 grams silver, and 2.1% lead. Some other big numbers, like 93 meters of 182 grams silver with some lead and zinc. And, of course, it's still early days, but that was phase two of the drilling. I think we could be looking at potentially a couple hundred million ounces of silver, but what's really exciting and really opens up the possibilities of something big is the fact that they've hit into a feeder zone that could really, I think, really increase the numbers very dramatically, the numbers and the grades. So it's still, as I say, early days, but the share price is down, knocked down so low. it's such a small market cap with something very potentially very big happening. And of course, this is a company that has it's really operating in large part as a project generator company, so it's not spending its own money on most of the projects. It has a huge portfolio of projects in Argentina and highly prospective areas of the country. And it has, you know, it has other companies spending their money to try to earn into them. They do have a major copper discovery that is being explored by a major company. And also, here's one of the things that I think really attracted my attention here was the recent addition of Carlos Maze to the company. Carlos, I think, really is a real class act, has a great history. He's an engineer, a mining engineer, but he was involved in the financing and development of the San Cristobal project in Bolivia. That's a huge silver mine, a $1 billion investment, and he really had a lot of success with that and putting that into production, getting it up and running, a 40-ton per day operation. And he's also been involved in the Clinton-Justra Sustainable Growth Initiative. And so I think he brings connections, the technical background that is very impressive. For a company that has such a minuscule market cap, I think this is one that could be absolutely huge. So that's the reason I personally own it. I've recommended it to my subscribers, and they have also been a sponsor on my own radio show. As a matter of full disclosure, I do have a vested interest in seeing this company succeed, but I think it will, and that's why I got involved with it. I think, you know, the management, Joe Grasso's been there since the inception of the company, went out and staked some fantastic properties. And now, of course, it's not the easiest time to raise capital, but the company, I think, is wisely developing this Chinchillas property because I think it has the potential to become a world-class silver deposit.
You know, another couple of interesting aspects. I understand the property is closely located to Barrick Gold's highly successful gold and silver mine, as well as Silver Standard's prolific silver mine.
That's right. And it's in the right address in the Bolivian tin silver belt, for sure. Well, we know now that there's something big going on here because of these kind of intersections, numerous ones. We don't have a resource. I think they're going to be calculating a resource fairly soon, and that, I think, might start to gain some investor attention. But I think we're going to see something very noteworthy taking place here. Yeah, I mean, I just think right now people don't like these kinds of companies, exploration companies, but this is one I think has a great chance for success.
Another property here, the Pescado property, is apparently adjacent to Yamana Gold's mine. Are you familiar with this property?
Well, yeah, to a lesser extent. I just know that they have properties everywhere that are, you know, highly prospective areas. And of course, the issue is to what extent can they get other companies to come in and fund them? Because one of the biggest risks that these little companies face, especially in markets like this, is getting other companies, you know, is dilution. But, you know, we're looking at a share structure here with, I think we're looking at 41 or 42 million shares outstanding only, you know, with such a low share price. If they get some traction in the Chinchillas or the copper deposit comes in big, which is being explored by a major company, then I think this company share price could really take off. Well, I just don't see a lot of downside risk from these current levels. I mean, that's maybe a dangerous thing to say, but given what this at the Chinchillas and given all this company has going for it, I think this is a very enviable entry point.
Very good. Well, let's move on now to the Timmins Gold Company. Apparently, they own and operate the San Francisco Gold Mine. That's their flagship operation in Sonora, Mexico. I understand that they have also had some interesting news. Gold reserves of 1.33 million ounces, reported record production of about 28,000 gold ounces for the first quarter of the year. Any comments here on Timmins?
Oh, yeah. Timmins has been a longtime favorite. I picked up my newsletter years ago when it was selling for pennies, so we've had a lot of success with Timmins. But I tell you that what this company is really executing, you know what, I'm very, very selective on when it comes to exploration companies these days, and the one we just talked about, Golden Arrow, is one I love a lot for reasons that I just really discussed. But for the most part, in this market situation, I want to own companies that are producing cash flows that can grow organically. And growth is, you know, it's what we're talking about with Timmins and good, solid cash flows. They earned 25 cents a share this last year, 2012, versus 15 cents, 2011. The stock price is down very considerably. It's down to $2.50, 144 million shares outstanding, so it gives the market cap around $365 million, but it had operating profits last year of $60 million. It, as I say, earned 25 cents a share. Those numbers should improve this year because the company is projecting production this year of 125 to 130,000 ounces of gold compared to 94,000 last year at similar costs, cash costs of around $700 to $750. But again, it's I think they have the potential to grow. It's a low-grade, open-pit, heap leach situation, but it's my understanding they have the potential to really increase very substantially. Of course, as you mentioned, with 1.3 million ounces of gold, that gives the company at these levels, you know, a good 10 years of operating potential there. But they have lots of exploration potential. So internal growth, you know, they just recently increased their crushing facility, which is really allowing them to increase their production right now. But I think the longer term, this company has a chance to grow continually, to continue to grow its production and earnings. So to be able to have cash at a time when there's a lot of companies can't make ends meet, exploration companies that have spent millions of dollars putting down drill holes, gathering data, you know, partially proving up projects, companies that have the cash flow to grow either organically with the projects they already have or to go out and scrape up some companies that can't move their projects forward, I think puts Timmins in a very enviable position, especially with its share price down recently from around $3 when I first started looking at it again to around $2.50. I think it's a very good situation.
Timmins also has caught the attention of institutional investors, which own apparently 60% of the shares outstanding, big names like Oppenheimer. But I also wanted to give you a chance to touch on the infrastructure. That's, of course, an important component of success. Timmins has access, apparently, to the Pan American Highway. It has water rights, power grid connections, and a skilled local labor force. Also, solid community relations. The nation is considered a mining-friendly area. Any other comments on Timmins?
No, I think you stated it well. Of course, that's infrastructure is always very, very important. No, I think that pretty well summarizes it. I just think, you know, cash flow, growth, internal, organically, they don't have to go out and issue more shares. Very important issue in this day and age, especially in this market. So these are the kind of opportunities where you can, you know, pick up companies that are really cheap, that have the goods, that are growing, and Timmins is certainly among my favorites in that regard.
Very good. Well, Mr. J. Taylor, we want to thank you for your comments on both companies today. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners as we wrap up?
Yeah, only that I think that we're nearing a bottom in this. I don't know that we're at the bottom yet in this decline in the gold and silver price.
Robert Kiyosaki has sold over 30 million books worldwide, but did you know he's also a prepper? That's right. He's stockpiling precious metals and survival goods, and he was doing so long before it became the trendy thing to do. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the best-selling author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad book series, Robert Kiyosaki. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Chris. I like your program.
You know, you say that the middle class is disappearing around Europe, and you note that if the U.S. dollar continues its decline, the world could actually collapse. Could you tell us more, please?
I'm a baby boomer, and I remember in the 60s when President Johnson said he was going to save the poor. They obviously didn't do a good job on that. In this last election, you have both Romney and Obama wanting to save the middle class. Tragic, but I think it's kind of funny. Anytime the presidential candidates want to save you, what's really tragic is that the middle class is now sliding into poverty. So today I was reading this article that in America, the problem isn't unemployment. The problem is underemployment. And in America alone, there's 146 million working people with jobs, working Americans, who are not earning enough to survive. In other words, if they need $10 per day, they're making $9. And 147 million of them, and soon some of them will start retiring, and then they'll start collecting more money. So We're sitting on a crisis that's huge.
It's a startling statistic. We've been using that 147 figure on the show for about a year now, and you are right. The number breaks down that the underemployed, or what some folks are referring to as the near poverty line, is roughly half of the country right now. That seems like a scenario for serious social unrest. Any thoughts?
You're speaking to the choir here. I don't know how people survive. And the person called these people the invisible people. Like, you know, you walk in down the hotel room and they're the guys cleaning your rooms or doing stuff around the place. You just don't see them. They're hardworking people. And it really breaks my heart that they work for nothing or that they even do work. You know, I mean, I know people who would rather not work and just collect welfare or entitlements. It's now called entitlements. You're entitled to it. So many of these people, if they weren't so honorable, they would just be the 47% who gets paid to do nothing.
Apparently, there are a huge number of millionaires collecting welfare payments at this time, workers' compensation and related payments. So, I mean, you know, maybe there are disincentives for almost every section of our society right now. You also point out that you're concerned that rioting could become intense in the U.S. once the economy starts to unravel. Won't authorities keep handing out new social incentives like our food stamps? You know, 48 million people currently on food stamps, and you say there's only 3 days of groceries on the shelves. How much time do you think for the music stops here?
I just believe, like a Boy Scout, to be prepared. I was in Dallas Airport the other day, and a bunch of women came by, and they're all healthy women. I mean, they were, you know, in their 40s and all this, obviously able-bodied, and they were really proudly wearing T-shirts that say, "I'm the 47% that doesn't work and doesn't pay taxes." I'm going, holy mackerel. You know, I mean, what has happened to us? What happened to the American dream? The people came over from both Europe and Asia to come here and build something for yourself. And now people think they're entitled to things. It's tragic.
You know, I think a big part of this is when you start to tax folks into oblivion, you reduce those incentives that, you know, their ancestors had. I mean, once you lose that entrepreneurial spirit, it removes the drive that you have to create new ideas, new products, new services, and you start to fall into a malaise.
Tout my latest, my greatest new book is called Why A Students Work for C Students and B Students Work for the Government. And the premise of that book, which was just released, is that we don't have a financial crisis. We have an educational crisis. And the question I have for people is, where are people taught the idea that you're entitled to something? It's in school. And they don't teach, you know, as a young boy, I'm in my 60s now, but as a boy of 9 and 10, I said, you know, why don't you teach me about money? Oh, money's evil. And these are people like my poor dad, good people who are school teachers who know nothing about money. And these same people, again, they're good people, most of them, are teaching your kids 8 hours a day in school. And we still don't teach kids anything about money. I had this one teacher say to me, well, we're teaching kids to balance a checkbook. And I said, ma'am, checkbooks aren't the problem. Credit card debt and student loan debt's the problem. Oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm going, they're so out of touch. They're good people, but they're basically socialists.
I've heard it said that a person who lives just beyond their means, misery, those who live just under their means, contentment and happiness. And I think it would do us all a lot of good to have incorporated that into our, I guess, our educational system early on. You drink the Kool-Aid of debt. It's out there in so many forms now, from credit cards, student loans, car payments, mortgages. They have lots of fancy names for it, and they're awfully glad to hand you the documents. But in the final analysis, it does tend to get the everyday folks in trouble, not referring to financiers like yourself who have the knowledge and understanding of how to wisely use debt and equity. I'm referring to the everyday folks who get themselves caught into the debt trap. You know, you're also on record that at some point the crowd is going to rush to the safe harbor of gold and silver. Estimates show that very few, if any, Americans have any gold or silver, precious metals of any substance, maybe less than 1 or 2%. So what's it going to take to turn people back to these barbarous relics?
Well, that's a good question also. As you know, the gold come up from approximately 1900 to around 1400 an ounce. And when my friends asked me why that happens, I said, well, it's been a 10-year run, and so it had to have a pullback. But also there was something else that happened in between the start, which is the year 2000, where it was at approximately $300 an ounce to when it hit $1,900 an ounce. What happened was the amateurs got into the market, and the amateurs came in through these things called ETFs. And excuse me, I don't buy these things. I don't know that. I think they're GLD and SLV. I buy the hard asset, or I buy the mining companies. So what happened is these amateurs came into the market, and when it was around 1900, they started piling in. And then, as you know, when amateurs come in, the pros pull the rug on them, and the thing went down. So I think that scared off the amateurs. You know, they're now saying, well, it is a barbarous metal and all this, which is kind of good, because I see it at gold at $1,300 an ounce, another time to start buying for me. So my whole recommendation for people is always this. You don't just buy because something's going up. You know, Warren Buffett said the stupidest reason to buy something is because the price is going up. You must understand the underlying fundamentals of why the price is going up. So to understand what's going on in the world today, I look at Japan, which has now gone to QE infinity, and they're going to print. Europe is slowing down, so they're going to have to print. China is slowing down. They have to print. So it's going to make America look good for a while, because people will be rushing from Asia and Europe into America, which gives us this false sense of a good economy. But eventually that sleigh ride has to end also. They just can't keep pumping fiat money into the United States, because that money is now looking for a home, which is going to cause inflation. So that's why, you know, I love gold. I've always loved gold. You know, as my friend Ron Paul said, he says, you know, 200 years ago, Spanish galleons went down, and 200 years later, people still die for gold. But 200 years from now, nobody's going to die for the dollar.
Exactly right. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, the paper market for the precious metals cratered, and we saw that break below support. We saw something similar in 2008, 2009. Premiums explode. For instance, right now at the APMEX, last time I checked, you could buy a 100-ounce silver bar for not much less than $29, $30 an ounce, even though the paper price is around $22, $23 an ounce. So we see this disconnect, if you will, between the paper and the premium. That usually sets the stage for opportunity. But I wanted to also move on to the deflation, hyperinflation argument. You seem to think that we're going to have one or the other, and every time the precious metals swoon, the deflationists claim victory. But, you know, I still see the trend sharply higher in gold in the long, long term.
Well, in the short term, it's collapse, as you know. And collapse is as bad as it gets, and I'm really glad Bernanke, I mean, as much as I disagree with his policy, I'm glad he printed money to prevent a collapse, because if it had collapsed, we'd be dead for a long time. We might have cleaned it up faster, but this printing money keeps us alive longer. Look, you got to take a bigger view of it. When you look at the last depression, let's say around 1930, the reason America came out of it, people say because of World War II, that's not really true. Why we came out of it, the Bretton Agreement was signed, and the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency of the world. But the other thing that happened that is different than this depression is in 1945, when the so-called depression so-called ended, is that we had factories back after World War II. And today, America doesn't have any factories. So during this depression, there's no jobs. There's only low-paying service jobs. So when I look at the first depression, 1930, and today's depression at 2013, I say, what's missing? What's missing are factories and high-paying jobs. So I think that deflation is going to run longer versus inflation. Now, there's going to be inflation in gold and oil and food. Of course, the government doesn't count that as inflation. So anyway, if you're going to play this market or be in the gold market, you have to understand what's different from this depression from the depression of our parents. The depression of our parents, there were jobs. This depression, no jobs. That's going to cause havoc on the whole financial systems throughout the world.
jobs are such an important component here. You know, we're still roughly 7.9% on the national unemployment rate. The Fed has targeted, as you know, 6.5%, the level where they claim they'll pull back on the QE and maybe adjust interest rates. So we're still a good distance away from there. Also, let's take a look at Japan. They're ramping up stimulus like never before. There is talk of a currency war there. And that, of course, has sent the Nikkei to record levels, which is their stated goal. So when you bring all this stimulus together, add in Europe, add in China as well, you know, you've got a situation where I would certainly want to have something that was going to protect my purchasing power.
I hope you've explained this, but what happens is when Japan devalues the yen, that makes the dollar expensive. So if the dollar is expensive, then we export less. So that means if the U.S. is going to compete with Japan, it also must devalue the dollar, which makes our exports more affordable, but it makes life more expensive inside the U.S. So that's why I found it really surprising the last few weeks that the price of gold came down. At the same time, Abe, the Japanese prime minister, said he was going to print. In my mind, which shows you how much I know, the price of gold should have gone up when Abe, which is Japan, announces a huge stimulus called printing money, devaluing the purchasing power of the yen, which will ultimately devalue the purchasing power of the dollar, which will make gold more expensive. But as I said, one of the reasons, many reasons for the crash in the price of gold, one of them is the amateurs got out of gold ETFs and silver ETFs. Plus, you had Cyprus. Who knows what went on there? So I just look at this whole thing as, well, okay, when it gets down to around 1300 for gold, I'm going to come back in with my pickup truck.
Well, you know, actually, you are correct. The price of gold in terms of yen exploded on that announcement from Prime Minister Abe. Gold actually hit an all-time record high on their monetary stimulus. I also wanted to touch a bit on this talk of ATM shutting down during the Hurricane Katrina disaster in the Gulf, and more recently with the Hurricane Sandy event on the East Coast. Is America facing a Cyprus-like event where people wake up to empty ATMs and take massive haircuts on their savings accounts?
Well, there already are a Cyprus. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You don't just buy gold to buy gold. You have to understand the whole monetary system. And that goes back to 1944 when the Bretton Woods Agreement was signed and the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency. In other words, instead of saving gold, they saved dollars. Then in 71, a few years later, Nixon took us off the gold standard, which meant the United States could just rob the world. So they robbed your savings. That's why I've always said at Rich Dad, savers are losers. It's because you put, let's say, $100 in the bank, and the bank prints $100, well, then your savings just went down by 50%. So they're doing the Cyprus event just by stimulus or quantitative easing, printing money. The reason Cyprus couldn't do that is because they don't have the printing press. So they had to then steal directly via taxes from the shareholders, which they never really did because the money came out through England anyway for the rich Russians. But the point here is the average person with no financial education, you're getting, which is the reason, you know, people like you and I recommend gold and silver, is because they really can't just manipulate it. And well, they do manipulate it, but not as much as paper money.
Exactly. They can't print it, I guess, is what your point is. There's actually some talk that J.P. Morgan was bailed out via the powers that be by crashing the precious metals because of their allegedly huge naked short position on silver. Of course, you also alluded to the inflation situation where people have called it the cruelest of taxes. You really have no vote on inflation, where you can vote down, you know, or kick out the folks who raise your taxes. This is an invisible tax, if you will, and unfortunately, it's difficult to gauge. It's difficult to understand for those who have, as you say, limited access to information and education on the subject. So that's going to be, I think, a huge factor going forward. Also wanted to talk to you about gold confiscation. Can you envision a time when governments make ownership so costly through taxes and regulations that people are tricked into giving up their metal their safety net, their precious metals. For instance, you may have read that in Houston, Texas, all gold sales now require the seller to submit to fingerprinting. Should folks own precious metals offshore to protect against something like this?
Singapore has a great offshore program. I went to check it out. It's really, really good. You know, your private jet pulls up, and it pulls up right next to the modern facility, and your gold goes right into storage, and the jet continues on. I mean, I was there to watch it. So the thing I'm saying, I don't do that. I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying that that's what the rich really do. I always recommend, you know, because I wasn't not, you know, I'm not mega rich, but the biggest asset you have is your education, which is why for years with Rich Dad Poor Dad, I said, why don't we have financial education in school? Well, because that way you can do whatever you like to them. And so if you're still saving money and have your money in mutual funds, that's the most manipulated. At least gold and silver, they have to. It's harder to manipulate. So I'd rather have gold and silver than cash or mutual funds.
Fortuitous that you'd mentioned Singapore. One of the other guests on the show this week will be Jim Rogers, who, of course, has a home in Singapore. And he is a big fan of the yellow metal. And like yourself, he's actually looking forward to this drop, has been excited by the fact that it's pulled back and is interested in loading the boat or backing up the pickup truck as well on gold. But, you know, this deluge has had an immediate impact on demand. You've probably read that there's a gold rush right now in India and China, particularly in India because of the upcoming wedding season and important festivals there. They tend to have dowry-related purchases. Demand is expected to be at record once again all the way through June and July. Are you factoring any of this into your analysis?
Yeah, I've been a gold bug since 72. And I've always heard those things and all that stuff, and I like rumors just as much as anybody else. But the reason I buy gold and silver comes down to one thing, is I don't trust my government. So what's my way of saying, if you trust your government to do a good job running the economy, then buy stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. If you don't trust your government, buy gold and silver. That's as simple as I can get with it, because it comes down to management of the economy. And when I see what our government, I'm not Republican or Democrat, is how they're managing this economy, then you look a few years into the future, the biggest liabilities of all, Social Security and Medicare, and you've got to ask yourself, is it going to solve the Medicare and Social Security problem? No. I don't think anybody can. Could Hillary do it? Could Marco Rubio do it? No. So that's why I don't trust my government or my leaders. I rather trust gold and silver. And that's as simple as my thoughts are. I mean, I don't want to get into conspiracies and all that stuff. I just rather have gold and silver.
Many Americans agree with you. Sales of American Gold Eagles exceeded the entire sales figure last month, and only 2 days of this month, the U.S. Mint had a record sales of 153,000 ounces already, and there was still about a week left in the month so far, that there just won't be enough to go around. I mean, will people be prepared when the big collapse finally arrives?
I really don't know any of that. I can plug my book as why A students work for C students and B students work for the government. It talks about how my rich dad, starting at age 9, taught me how to print my own money. Well, I just copy the Fed. I also copy the tax laws of the rich. And so once I understood this all financial education, once I understood that, it's kind of the reverse gold process where the Fed is printing money. What I do is I print money also, but I buy gold with my money. But I have been trained to print my own money. And you can too. And that's what I cover in my book. Also, what's hard for people to understand, which took a long time writing why A students work for C students, is debt and taxes make the poor and middle class poor. Debt and taxes make the rich rich. So if you can understand that every coin has at least three sides, head, tails, and the edge of the coin, the purpose of why A students work for C students was to have you see both sides of the coin from the edge, so you can make up your own mind which way you want to go. So since it's relatively easy for me to make money, then I just buy gold. If you don't have, if you're having trouble making money, then you have other problems. You see, that's the whole reason I say we don't have a financial crisis. We have an educational crisis. I mean, how many people graduated from school with good grades who are still broke? Why is that? Why is it that Romney made $21 million in the campaign around 2011. He paid 13% in taxes, and Obama made $3 million and paid 23% in taxes. And what I cover in why A students work for C students is how Romney pays 13% and how Obama pays 23%. That's financial education. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, because I like to get my interest, I like to get my tax rate down to zero. But I've been trained to do that. Most people have not. And I do it legally, but so the whole point here is this: without financial education, a lot of times you're just guessing at all this stuff, trying to figure out which way Obama, whoever's next, or Bush, whoever's elected next, goes. I personally don't trust any of them. I'd rather trust myself. And that's really kind of why I study, and I like being an American. I just don't trust my government.
Sounds like another must-read book. Any parting comments, sir, for the listeners today?
I'll say it again. You know, it's opposite. Debt and taxes make person poor, and debt and taxes make the rich rich. And if you want to find out why, that's where financial education comes from. Like, I make millions of dollars and pay 0% in tax legally. And that's why I just buy gold, because I really don't need cash, because I learned to print my own money. And really, that's what I, and the book is written for parents with kids. So if you're worried about your kids' education, you should be, because schools will never teach them about money. And that's why I wrote Why A Students Work for C Students, is for parents who are concerned, or grandparents concerned, about their child's financial education.
Well, I know that folks are going to absolutely want to pick up another copy. Do you recommend they try Barnes & Noble, maybe Amazon.com?
Well, whatever is closest to them. I would encourage them to support their local Barnes & Noble, or better yet, their local bookstore, because those guys are struggling and they need help. So support your local economy.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. There's a lot of things I could discuss this week. My attendance at Freedom Fest and what Steve Forbes and Rand Paul had to say, among others, or the fact that Detroit just became the largest city to ever file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. Or I could discuss what turned out to be the single most important event of the week, which served as a reminder, and should serve as a wake-up call, that each of us must prepare for that inevitable morning when we will wake up to a world that has changed as much as it did on September 11th, 2001. Fortunately, what I am about to share was a false alarm, but it could have been real, devastatingly real. Wednesday morning, about 6:30 a.m., I awoke to a power outage in southern Las Vegas. Nothing worked, not the refrigerator, not the internet, not the air conditioner. And the last several weeks, we've had temperatures ranging from 104 to 118 degrees. Nothing to mess around with. I tried calling the power company, but got a busy signal on the 24-hour emergency line, which did not inspire confidence. Customer service didn't open until 7:30 a.m. When I finally got through at 7:35 a.m., the gentleman told me they had no idea what the cause of the outage was, but they estimated 2,200 homes were without energy. He also told me it could be noon or even later until the cause was known or fixed. I decided to head to McDonald's and grab breakfast. The electric garage door wouldn't open, so I had to do it manually. When I arrived at McDonald's, there was a paper sign taped on the door that said, "Closed due to power failure." People were visibly worried and concerned. So was I. The biggest concern was the excessive heat with no air conditioning. I began making mental contingency plans in case the outage was more widespread, like booking a hotel room in an unaffected part of town. But what if, God forbid, it was the beginning of some kind of infrastructure terror attack? Did I have enough cash? Were the banks going to open? Was I safe in my present location? If necessary, what would be a safe place to seek sanctuary? Drive to Utah, Arizona, California, or grab a flight somewhere? The traffic lights by the McDonald's were out, and I could see people were getting more agitated. Fortunately, about 8 a.m., as I was driving to an alternative restaurant, the traffic lights started working. I received a phone call telling me the electricity was back on. It's easy to brush this off as something trivial. But what if it wasn't? What if the lights and power of Las Vegas really did go out and stay out against the backdrop of extremely hot temperatures? What if the lights and power went off and stayed off in your city? Or what if something just as potentially volatile happened where you live tomorrow? What would you do? Do you have plans? Contingency plans? Or are you just going to take a wait-and-see approach? Insurance is cheap when you buy it in advance. It's extremely expensive and often not available when you try and obtain it after something devastating has happened. The time to buy fire insurance is before your house starts burning. The time to buy gold and silver is before the financial system collapses again. The time to plan for natural or man-made disasters is before they happen or are foisted upon us. A simple power outage this week was far more than a reminder. It was a major league wake-up call that the secret to conquering change is being prepared for it. Personally speaking, I can tell you, I have fortified my game plan to include several additional response scenarios should something like this happen again. And it will. Are you ready at your end? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Welcome back, Steve Forbes.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Although 50 million people qualify for food stamps and most households receive some form of government assistance, according to the Census Bureau, nearly half of Americans are either at or near the poverty level. Is this due to a flaw in the capitalist system, or is it primarily a result of big government and over-regulation?
You put your finger on it, an environment that is hostile to free enterprise. Free enterprise, free markets, which are people allowed to do things, create things, take risks, expand businesses, fail, rise up again, is how we've achieved the highest standard of living in human history. And today we have the obstacles of a weak dollar, overspending by government because that takes resources from you, tax code, and the major uncertainties of Obamacare.
Currently, only 7% of Americans, if you can believe this number, are classified as self-employed, the lowest figure in our national history. Isn't the entrepreneur the backbone of capitalism? And if so, how can the system be sustained without that spirit?
Well, one of the reasons that America has grown faster than other developed nations, traditionally grown much faster than Western Europe, we've been growing in the last 20 years much faster than Japan, is precisely because we create new entities, new small companies today that become the big companies of tomorrow. And when you have a hostile environment to that entrepreneurial spirit, with regulations that force banks not to make as many loans to small businesses, new startups, then you get a semi-stagnant economy. We're like a car on an open highway going 40 miles an hour, and we should be going 70 or 80.
It makes one wonder if our regulators and legislators have forgotten that big businesses all began as small businesses.
Take the 1970s, which were a horrible decade, terrible inflation and ever-rising taxes before Reagan came in. In that decade, look at the little things that were coming up that became the big things of tomorrow. Apple, Microsoft, Oracle, Amgen, Southwest Airlines, FedEx. And if you hadn't had the benign environment that Reagan created and that lasted through the early part of the last decade, those companies would have had stunted growth.
What would you suggest, then, to restore and encourage small business?
Well, I think you need several things. One is a benign tax code. We need lower tax rates and a drastically simpler tax code so that people can focus on real things. You know, we spend 6.5 billion hours, and this number comes from the IRS. We spend more than 6 billion hours a year filling out tax forms. That's the equivalent of over 3 million full-time jobs. We also have overspending. Where do the resources come from? They come from us, either through taxation, borrowing, or printing of money, which is another form of taxation. And then you have a weak dollar. When you have an uncertain dollar, that makes investing in the future more problematic. You get less of it if you don't know what you're going to get paid back in. We should have learned this from the 1970s. And when you have a peculiar new health system where if you have a growing business and you reach 50 people and you have to decide, do we continue to grow and take on massive new costs, or do we just put a cap on and start another business?
I'm sure you'd agree that earnings and wealth that come from one's own effort and not from the government pay the best dividends. I would even add that nothing seems to breed contempt as quickly as unearned rewards. How can our legislators protect those who truly need assistance while encouraging self-reliance and individual accomplishment?
We did it for almost 200 years before we got the massive growth of big government, having that kind of entrepreneurial environment. Right now, there are plenty of people in Washington who think they have a big government mentality, who think the government should guide the economy and guide the world. So if we make reforms like tying the dollar to gold, having a flat tax so you can do your tax return either with a few keystrokes or on the back of an envelope, almost, when you have patients in control of health care and a little bit of spending restraint, major positive things will happen.
I'd like to shift to your market perspectives. 2013 has rewarded equities investors handsomely. In your estimation, though, is this market enthusiasm becoming overextended?
Well, one hesitates to predict anything on the market because, as Morgan said, J.P. Morgan, it fluctuates. I think what you see unfolding in the market today is anticipation that for all of our current problems, we're going to find ways around them. The economy will be a little better this year than last year, barring a blow up in the Middle East or in Asia. But we're still like that baseball hitter. We've had a slump and now we're hitting 250 when we should be hitting 350.
You've also gone on record in recent years supporting the need to return to a sound money system. Now that the precious metals have clearly released considerable steam, are gold and silver nearing favorable valuation levels?
Well, you should always have a little bit of gold just to as an insurance policy on your portfolio. And if you buy one of those metals, you should not do it with the mind of a trader. Because unless you have a real instinct for it, and despite our egos, 99% of us don't, you will get whipsawed, especially if you buy it on credit, you know, using margin. So see it as an insurance policy, and if it goes down, it usually means the stock market's going up. And if it's going up, it means your stocks are going down. So it's an insurance policy.
Well, recently, many global central banks have demanded the return of stored and leased gold from the vaults of the United States and other Western nations. The trend seems to be picking up steam here, with the Bundesbank asking for most, if not all, of its gold. Of course, France returned its lion's share in just a few weeks' time, but the United States is asking for 7 years to return the bulk of its gold to Germany. Do you have any thoughts on this and what it might foretell?
The key thing to keep in mind about gold is, thankfully, there is so much of it around the world. It's a very hard market to manipulate for more than a day or two. I think in the next few years, we will be going back to a gold standard, perhaps short as 4 years, maybe as long as 8 or 10. But one way or the other, it will happen. For 180 years, we had the dollar linked to gold, and it worked pretty well. And we've seen recently what happens when you don't have it. It's like a clock that doesn't have 60 minutes in a day. The number of minutes change each day. That makes for a very chaotic world.
I think we have begun to see signs of that with the Cyprus event. Investors woke up and on a Monday morning, many of whom thought their funds were safe, but anything over the limit evaporated. And there is considerable talk in Canada and the United States with regard to bail-ins. A very similar situation might occur in the Western world should another credit crisis unfold as we saw in 2008-2009. Do you think investors should be making contingency plans for another MF Global or Cyprus-like event?
Well, it's hard to predict these things, and so I think you have to take the mindset. For your retirement fund, especially if you're in your 40s, early 50s, you're not going to need the money for a number of years. Then you just gear yourself and ride the storm through. Dollar cost averaging, putting in a certain amount each month or each quarter, that's the way to go. For your the other part of your portfolio, you should always have some cash, even when times look good. And then when opportunities rise up, you're in a position to scoop them up. So a little common sense goes a long way, but don't try to be a market timer. That way you just reward your broker, not yourself.
You went on record recently noting that the bond market and perhaps even real estate might be a bit overextended or at least presenting less of an opportunity to investors.
Well, I think bonds are overpriced, and that doesn't mean they can't stay overpriced for a while longer, especially if the Federal Reserve continues to misbehave. But there's no way, given the government's finances, that a 30-year bond should be 3% or a 10-year bond 2%. So it's just a matter of time when that thing unravels. And the other thing you've got to be very careful of is, unless you know a market well, if you're in commercial real estate, is farmland. Farmland has gone up a lot in recent years, doubled. And I just am old enough to remember the 70s when we had this kind of surge. Didn't end very happily. And I think a lot of people are buying hard assets because of the fear of what the Federal Reserve is doing. But as we saw with Ronald Reagan, those periods don't last forever. And the 1980s were a rough time for farmland, for commodities. And so I think investors just got to be aware of that.
So I would guess then that you would say that Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke might make good with regard to increasing interest rates at some point, pulling back on the reins somewhat with regard to stimulus and quantitative easing.
I think there's a possibility of that, particularly if the U.S. economy shows signs of growth. This year, I think we may get up to 3% after the second quarter. I don't think the second quarter is going to be a barn burner. 3% looks good compared to the last 3 years.
3% growth may not look good relative to our past as a nation, but compared to, let's say, Europe, for instance, it's a phenomenal number. Maybe that's part of the influx of funds into our equities markets, global investors looking for higher returns. Anything else that investors should be watching?
I think investors should sometimes do less watching, stick to fundamentals, and if they want to do watching, watch their politicians.
Any contact information, direct folks to pick up a copy of the Freedom Manifesto.
Well, Freedom Manifestos at your bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's Freedom Manifesto, Why Free Markets Are Moral and Big Government Isn't. You can follow me on Twitter. This is Steve Forbes, CEO. And we have a great website, Forbes.com. So we can connect one way or the other.
Very good. Mr. Forbes, we can't thank you enough today for taking time out of your busy schedule for us.
You too, Chris. Thank you.